Good morning, happy Sunday, and welcome to On the Weekend Edition. I am your host, Brian Pettaway, and this is the very first Sunday of Black History Month, and absolutely by design, it was set up to be the shortest month of the year. I mean, God forbid we have 31 days of Black History Month. We can only have 28. That makes it okay, I guess. Just adding insult to injury, I get it, but we're going to do what black folks have been doing since we've come to this country, and that's making the most out of the least. In fact, we do it so well that when we create something out of nothing, it's oftentimes replicated or stolen. Or in the case of Tulsa, Oklahoma, where we created Black Wall Street, where that success could not be replicated or stolen, they just destroyed it. Now, of course, this being Black History Month, I'm going to talk about some of those things that have happened to us in the course of history in this country. But I'm not going to dwell on the negative because, you know, there's been a lot of positive things that have happened too. One of those positive things or positive people is here with me today. Judge Robert Bell is one of these people that if you don't know his story, you definitely want to hear it. And if you've read about him and you're familiar, well, now you get an opportunity to hear it from the horse's mouth. Because trust me when I tell you, he pulls no punches. He is straight to the point. No chaser. Also, of course, you've got the petty. And although there are no games this weekend in the NFL, you still might want to listen to what he has to say today because he's going to give you information as to what the quarterbacks are up to, who's healthy, who's not. He's going to talk about the historical significance of two black quarterbacks starting in a Super Bowl. And I'm going to ask him to give us a very early prediction as to who's going to win the Super Bowl. So you definitely want to hear that. And of course, you've got me. I'm going to start off with what I like to do most, and that is give news from the past week and current events. But before I get into that, I just want to say, you know, in life, you're going to always have naysayers. Those negative people around you that no matter what you say you're going to try, they're going to always tell you why you shouldn't try it, right? Well, if you're fortunate, contrary to those people, you're going to have people that are going to be in your corner. And I have someone, fortunately for me, that's been listening to me on the air since I started with the news segments on the April Watch Live show. Now, she has followed me over here. She and her husband have followed me over here to On the Weekend Edition for Sunday mornings. And she listens faithfully every Sunday morning. And I'm so thankful. Sonia Scott Bushrod is an amazing person. And incredibly supportive. And again, she and her husband listen every Sunday morning. And, you know, I ask for people to send me feedback for the show. And last week, you know, she made some very good points. And I just want to read them because I promised that I would. And it's very thought-provoking. But she said, "Good morning, Brian. I can't watch the Tyre Nichols beating just like I can't watch any of the other ones." Because we spoke about Tyre Nichols last week. And she said, "I do agree that those police officers were charged and fired quickly because they were black." She said, "I think the officers thought that they would get the same treatment as most of their other counterparts, their white counterparts. They were probably counting on suspension with pay until an investigation." She said, "I also believe that they were trying to get better clout with their peers and their ranks for their jobs. Although all of what they were thinking is stupid, I can't think of any other reason why they would do this disgusting act." Now, I also said that I am not a fan of Benjamin Crump's, and I asked people to let me know how they felt about him. And she wrote back, "Benjamin Crump probably is an ambulance chaser, but he gets things done." And to that, Sonia, I will say, you're right. I mean, looking at it through that lens, he does bring a lot of attention, media attention, to these problems. She also wrote, "Thank you for having Kirk Whalum on the show. I was not aware that he was the saxophonist on Whitney Houston's I Will Always Love You." She said, "I love everything Whitney." And she wrote, "You and your brother also had me cracking up," my brother being the petty, of course. "And another excellent show for the books." So here's a side note, all right? I had a very tough week. My Uncle Mickey, Andrew Cromer, who I loved very much, passed away last week on Sunday. And it was a very tough week, and I didn't really know if I had it in me to put a show together. It was going to take a lot out of me. My uncle was in the hospital for 12 days, and 5 of those days were in hospice. And, you know, hospice is 24 hours because death is imminent and there are no visiting hours. You get there and you stay there for as long as you want because you don't know when your loved one is going to expire. So I was there every day. And in fact, last Sunday, after the show, I was at the hospital sitting next to his bed. I had set the chair up next to his bed and I had the playoff game had just started. And my uncle loved football. And I just figured even though he's unconscious and sedated, I just believe that he could still hear me And so my cousin and I, Bernard Stokes, we would take shifts because my uncle had no children. And neither one of us, Bernard or I, wanted him to be alone when he died. So I'm in the room with my uncle watching the game. And I'm not ashamed to tell you that I'm talking to him. I've got my arm on his forearm. And I'm talking to him about this game. You know what I mean? Knowing that he can't talk back, but I didn't care. And he drew his last breath and transitioned on. He passed away. And it was emotional. And at that point, I had not yet looked to see if I had any feedback from the show. Because that's not where my head was. And then I'm thinking, there's no way I'm going to do a show this week. But I checked my messages later on Instagram. And like clockwork, there's Sonia sending me the message that I just read to you guys. And it really put things in perspective for me. My uncle passed away. His life stopped. Mine didn't. And he would not want me to stop doing what I was doing because he was proud of what I was doing. And so my point is, first, is that you don't know how you're helping someone just by consistently supporting them. You just don't know what you do for them at their low moments when they don't think they have a reason to continue to do things. I mean, you just don't know. So again, let's try to support each other as much as we can when we can. And here's the other thing. I've never met Sonia Scott Bushrod. I've never met this woman or her husband. I wouldn't know them if they passed me on the street, not just by looking at them. I mean, I would not. But I'm going to make it a point to find you guys. And when I do, it's family hug because you feel like family to me at this point. All right, so now that I'm feeling great, I hope you're feeling great because I want to start talking about the things that have gone on this past week in the news. And I've got lots to say, so let's just jump right into it. Last week, on the first day of Black History Month, the first black person to ever be elected as governor of the state of Maryland gave the State of the State address. In his speech, Wes Moore declared war on child poverty. During his first week in office, he made public service a priority by creating the cabinet position of the Department of Service and Civil Innovation. Now, he's providing $18 million in his fiscal year 2024 budget proposal over the next 2 years to fund the department. The proposal provides high school seniors a paid opportunity to do community service for a year. And in his speech, he explained why that was so important to him.
While our young people give back, they also lay the foundation for their future success through job training, through mentorship program, and it creates a lifelong habit of service to our state.
What I find particularly interesting about Wes Moore is how he says things really without saying them. Now, when I interviewed him while he was running and campaigning to be governor, I asked him the question, why has Baltimore City not invested more in teen programs and in youth programs, after school programs? And he said, I'm not sure because there's certainly money in the budget. When I become governor, he said, I will involve everyone in the process of helping out. And that includes, in particular, teens. And I thought at that time, during that interview, well, you know, he's campaigning for the job and this sounds great. But how many people, once they reach the position for which they are campaigning, do what they say they're going to do? Not many. Not many politicians do that. But here we are, not even 2 weeks into his governorship, and already he's doing exactly what he said he was going to do. And not only that, but he's backing it by making it a part of his fiscal year 2024 budget, which means it's not going to stop anytime soon. And I applaud that. I appreciate it and I respect that. And what I'm hoping is that it rubs off on Brandon Scott, because teen violence is so out of control in this city. Just this week, there was a vigil held for a 23-year-old mother of two, Maya Moore, who was killed when caught in the crossfires of an open-air drug market right off of Pennsylvania Avenue. Not only was she killed, but in trying to drive away from this crossfire, she unfortunately crashed her car. And in that car were her two little boys, a 3-year-old and a 14-month-old. They were both critically injured. Now, understand, she was sitting in front of a restaurant waiting for carryout food. That's all she was doing with her two sons. A mother waiting for carryout food from a carryout restaurant, sitting in her car. And now her life, 23-year-old life, is gone. And her two boys, 3-year-old and 14-month-old boys, are without a mother and in a hospital because teenagers want to sell drugs, play gangster in an open-air drug market. Now, Eric Costello, who is a city council member and is the council member for that district, 11th district, has said that that area between Pennsylvania Avenue and the Upton area is one of the biggest, if not the biggest, open-air drug markets in the state. So if we know this, and we've known this, what are we doing about it? Two things come to mind. When I drive up North Avenue, where it intersects Pennsylvania Avenue, there's a store there right on the corner. It is a Baltimore Police Department squad car. There's never a cop in this car. It is sitting there as a deterrent for loiterers and drug dealers. But more than once, I've been sitting at the light at that intersection, and I see drug dealers completing drug transactions while sitting on the hood of that police car. So clearly, that ain't working. What else can we do? Now, Brandon Scott showed up at the scene of this murder, as he has been lately, showing up at these scenes. And he said that he is confident that they will find the people that are responsible for the death of Maya Moore. Because he said, and I quote, "We have the best homicide detectives in the world in this city." And that's a very bold statement. One, because the world is a big place, all right? But the other thing that makes it a ridiculous statement to brag about is the only way you get really, really good at something is when you do it over and over and over again. So if you've got the best homicide detectives in the world, it's because they're getting a whole lot of practice. And that means as a mayor, you're failing. And quickly, in national news, things are getting pretty serious. While we're concentrating on George Santos, or whoever he is, and Biden's top secret documents left in his house, the Chinese are floating spy balloons off the coast of Carolina, which we actually shot down yesterday. The Chinese surveillance balloon had been floating across the U.S. for a few days. President Biden had not been briefed on it until Wednesday, and once he was briefed on it, he'd said to shoot it down as quickly as possible. And it still took until yesterday to shoot the thing down. Now, industry pundits and lawmakers were questioning Biden's timing and why it took so long, but the national security officials warned Biden that the best time to do it was when it was over water, because we did not know what safety concerns it would cause if it was shot down over land. I mean, this thing is actually the size of three buses, and nobody knew what was inside of it. So shooting it down over land, in particular over an inhabited area, wasn't something that we were prepared to do. And because the U.S. could not control the thing, we had to wait until it actually floated over water, and that's when they shot it down. The Chinese did acknowledge on Friday that it is their balloon, but it claimed that it's primarily used for meteorological research and that it had been blown off course. And they issued a statement saying that the Chinese side regrets the unintended entry of the airship into U.S. airspace, and again, that it was a complete accident. I mean, the U.S. and Russia and China have all been playing this cat and mouse spy game for decades. And at some point, we all get caught with our hands in the cookie jar. And the best that we can hope for at that particular time is that no one is killed because of it. And lastly, the Memphis Police Department is currently investigating rumors regarding a possible connection between Tyre Nichols and the ex-wife or ex-girlfriend of one of the Memphis cops arrested and charged in Nichols' death. Earlier this week, Erica Williams, the director of communications at the Selby County District Attorney's Office, said that rumors about Nichols having a connection to the woman have not been confirmed. But the word on the street is that Tyre Nichols was in a relationship with and worked with Memphis Police Demetrius Haley's ex-girlfriend and baby's mother. And supposedly after the beating, Officer Haley took a picture of Tyre Nichols' face and sent it to his baby's mother. I don't care what the reason they beat this man the way that they beat him. It was all disgusting, cowardly behavior to me. So it doesn't matter to me. They are all worthy in their actions of the stiffest penalties that the law has to offer these guys. So we will see what happens. But honestly, it did look like it was a personal beating. It looked like it was something personal from the very beginning to the very end. So who knows? The truth will definitely eventually come out. All right, let's shift gears. We're going to talk about my guest that I have here today. I'm so happy and proud to have him. His service to this state and to the city has spanned decades. I mean decades, starting out as a young pioneer in the civil rights movement here in this city. And from that, being appointed to serve as chief judge on the Maryland Court of Appeals, the highest court in the state, and the very first African-American to ever hold that position. So ladies and gentlemen, please help me welcome Chief Judge retired Robert M. Bell. All right, Judge Bell, thank you so much for joining me this morning. I really appreciate your time. As I told you earlier, I'm very excited to have you. I am a pseudo-lawyer to some of my friends part-time. Though I rarely know what I'm talking about. It feels good to pretend like I do. So someone like you with all of your knowledge and expertise and time in, I really appreciate it. How are you feeling, sir?
Doing fine. And I appreciate the opportunity, and I appreciate you having me on.
It's definitely my pleasure. So I wanted to jump right into it because we don't have a whole lot of time, and you've done a lot in your life. But when first of all, as a kid, now I understand that your mom was a sharecropper. Is that right, back in North Carolina?
Yes. And she and my father separated, and she came to Baltimore
okay.
with her three children.
Now, my great-grandfather was a sharecropper in Tarboro, North Carolina, and he did the same
thing. That's not too far from Rocky Mount.
I have family in Rocky Mount as well.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they also moved to East Baltimore. Right, so
okay,
that seemed to be a thing at the time. But
well, that's true, because, you know, there were certain destinations from certain places in the South. One of them was Baltimore.
Okay.
For North Carolina. Because I had my uncle was here, I had two uncles here when my mother moved here.
Okay.
And so they formed a little community along with others. And, you know, we all pretty much remain North Carolinians. But in Baltimore.
Right. What year did you get here? What year did you guys move here?
Well, I've been here since I was about a year and a half. So I've been here, for 70-some years.
Wow, okay. So you've seen a lot of change here.
I was born in 43, so I was here by 45.
Okay. And mm-hmm. and what caused law? What stirred you to go into law?
This will surprise you. It was reading. I used to love mysteries, and one of the mystery books I used to read was Earl Stanley Gardner.
Okay.
And Earl Stanley Gardner wrote the Perry Mason mysteries.
Ah, okay.
And I got the bug right there because of the tendency to believe that lawyers help people, and that's what I wanted to do. And so, yeah, I started wanting to be a lawyer back then, and then it was reinforced by the fact that my relatives, my mother, my aunts and uncles, would always suggest that I talked a lot and I should be a lawyer. And that reinforced it for me, you know.
My grandmother used to tell me the same thing. Well, let me ask you a question. You know, it's interesting that you say that, because I thought you were going to tell me, because once upon a time, I believe I heard that you were involved in a sit-in.
I was.
Right, and you were 16 when that happened. Is that right?
That's correct. But that came after I had already intended to become a lawyer.
Ah, okay.
It had no influence on that decision.
Okay.
Have an influence on increasing my interest in trying to be a catalyst for ensuring equal rights for everybody.
Okay. Tell me about that sit-in. What happened?
Well, I was a student government president, a student council, I guess it was, at Dunbar High School.
Okay.
And the Morgan State College students were responsible for organizing the sit-in. And really, it was not only just a sit-in, but it was a picketing event down in downtown Baltimore. The sit-in was an adjunct to it. They came to Dunbar to recruit students to participate.
Okay.
I spoke to them, and my job was to try to get students to go along, and we ended up getting a bus to go downtown. So we went down to Baltimore Street and Calvert, where the block is, or the block down from the block up from the block.
Okay.
And we picketed those stores down there, those places of public accommodation. And then the group leader for my group decided to go up a couple of blocks away and see if we could find a restaurant that was open. And sure enough, we found one restaurant that was open, and we went in and sat in. And of course, they refused the service. The owner even came in and pleaded with us to leave, and we refused to do it. And then finally, they called the police. Police came, read the trespass statute, which was required. And when we refused to leave, he arrested us. Of course, the arrest was symbolic because the leader of my group was very accomplished.
Right.
He was able to negotiate a deal where we could go home and report to the police station on Monday morning. This was a Friday.
Okay.
And so we were symbolically arrested on Friday, reported for processing on Monday. And then we went to trial. We were tried in the juvenile court because we were juveniles.
Right.
And we were convicted, fined $10 in costs. But, of course, we appealed to the Court of Appeals.
Okay.
And the Court of Appeals affirmed the conviction, which prompted a petition for writ of certiorari to the Supreme Court of the United States. And they took the case. They did not decide the merits of it, however. They sent it back to the Court of Appeals because the law had changed from the time that we were arrested and convicted, had changed so that public accommodations were required in most places in Baltimore. And so the Supreme Court asked the Court of Appeals to review the situation or the case in light of the changed circumstances.
What year was this, sir?
The sit-in occurred in 1960, June 17th, 1960. The case was sent back to the Court of Appeals in 62, and the decision by the Court of Appeals was in 64.
Where was the country at that time as far as civil rights go? Because in 1960, things were just starting to roll, right? It hadn't become the popular thing at that particular time. Instead, it was still a very dangerous time. Is that right?
Well, yes. Most people say that the civil rights movement began with the sit-ins in Greensboro.
Right.
A&T students. That's not true. The sit-in mortgage students had been doing that for at least 10 years before that.
Really?
Yeah. But you're right. It was early days in that regard because very few students were involved in it at that time. Morgan had done it on a consistent basis, but it was only one school.
You were,
and it did not get any publicity.
As a 16-year-old, there was no fear? Like, I mean, you were a kid, you know what I mean?
No, but my fear came from my mother. I didn't tell my mother that I was going to participate. And the reason I didn't tell her was because I knew she would tell me no.
Yeah, absolutely.
I was convinced by the representative from Morgan that was the right thing to do. And okay. I was determined to do it. I was afraid that my mother would not let me do it, and so I didn't tell her. Yeah, I was afraid on the picket line.
Right.
Because there was a counter-protest. You know, when it happened in those days, you have a crowd go in and they picket, and the counter-picket begins. White folk would come in and taunt you.
Okay.
And hurl all kinds of epithets at you, and that happened that day. I mean, it was a scary situation with all these angry white people standing around you, yelling at you, calling you all kinds of names, and using all kinds of profanity. And so, yeah, it was really scary. But, of course, we had already agreed that once we went, we would remain nonviolent and we would not respond to it. And we were true to that.
You know, I think a lot of people misunderstand exactly how young people were during this movement. Like, it wasn't 30 and 40-year-olds that were causing this change.
Mm-hmm.
It was high school and college students that was causing this change. Mostly
college,
yeah.
College. You know, it's funny you mentioned it because high school students were could be a problem because you couldn't get any traction from a high school student if they followed the law. You know, as a high school student under 18 was a juvenile. Juvenile proceedings are different. You know, you're protected. You don't have the right to. You're not convicted. You are treated, so to speak.
Right.
And
so
you don't have the right to appeal. In Baltimore, fortunately, it was different. In Baltimore, I said we were tried in juvenile court. We were not. We were tried in adult court.
Okay.
In Baltimore, it was different because in Baltimore City, unlike the rest of the state, 16 years old made you an adult. Elsewhere in the state, 18 years old. Baltimore City, 16.
Okay.
And that's why it was that we were able to appeal the decision.
That's another reason why your mom would have been highly against you doing something like this at 16 years old.
Well, she would have been upset either way. It wouldn't make any difference. Because my mother's whole thing was, go to school, get an education, they can't take it away from you.
Right.
Make
right.
something of yourself.
And that was the conventional thinking of people, especially your mom, who had risked everything to come here, having
That's
suffered
right.
what she had suffered. I completely understand where she would be coming from. And why that would,
no question.
Would, you know.
But interestingly enough, once I had done it, she was as supportive as she could be.
That's awesome.
You know, because mothers are very protective, and the moment you find yourself into quote unquote trouble, they're going to be right there helping you extricate yourself from it.
Absolutely.
And that's where she was.
Now I understand that the NAACP got involved in this case. And
that's right.
You had people like, Juanita Jackson Mitchell and even Thurgood Marshall as a part
that's
of
right.
that team. Did you actually meet them?
No. Well, I met all of the local folk.
Right.
I didn't meet Thurgood Marshall until later.
Okay.
And he was only involved for a short time because he was appointed to the federal court shortly after our case was appealed. And then Constance Baker Motley took it over along with Jack Greenberg, who replaced Thurgood as the head of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund.
And that's when it got to the Supreme Court, you said, correct?
Right, it went to the Supreme Court. But the one person that I think we need to mention is Tucker Deary. The real driving force in the defense was Tucker Deary, who was a lawyer who was educated at Howard, and he had a PhD in law.
Oh, okay.
And was terribly committed to the case, and he remained with the case from beginning to the end. I think he deserves a whole lot of credit for a lot of the civil rights work that went on in back in those days.
I always wondered how black attorneys were treated in court as opposed to white attorneys. Because there's a difference in everything, especially at that time. So I always wondered if blacks had to play by a different rule, a different strategy, a different game than white attorneys did in arguing cases. And if it was obvious, is something that you guys formulated?
It depends. It really depended upon who you appeared before.
Okay.
Because there were certain judges who were just let's just call it what it was. They were just totally prejudiced.
Right.
And you could tell it in the way they responded to your representation. By the time I became a lawyer, of course, it had changed significantly because we had a lot more lawyers, black lawyers. But back in the old days, when we're talking about 1960s, when you had fewer lawyers, it differed from courtroom to courtroom.
Okay.
It turns out that the case was heard before Judge Burns, who I don't know whether you're familiar with politics in Maryland, but John Carl Burns was a judge, was first of all a state senator.
Okay.
And then he became a judge. Judge Burns was his father. And he was a guy who was very fair.
Okay.
And you didn't have that discrepancy in treatment between blacks and whites who appeared before him. But there were others who were notoriously bad. And so you went before them and you were prepared to appeal whatever happened.
Right, right. Your strategy was completely different.
Exactly right. But then there's a guy like Judge Eugene O'Neill, Eugene O'Dunn. He was the judge who tried the Donald Gaines Murray case.
Okay.
That Thurgood Marshall and Charles Hamilton Houston tried in Baltimore City. He granted the relief that was sought, and it was upheld by the Court of Appeals. He was a judge who not only treated blacks with respect, but he commingled with them. He appeared at their functions and spoke at invitation, at their invitation. So you had those folk, people like Eugene O'Donnell, but you had others who would just be loath to even be seen anywhere near a black lawyer.
Okay. Now you went to undergrad at Morgan State, which is where I went to school. My mother went to school. My brother went to school. So Morgan State is dear to me and my family. But you got your law degree at Harvard. There weren't a lot of black faces at Harvard either.
When I went, we were beginning to just get into that school in larger numbers. There were more than 20 when I went in my year, and that number increased for several years after that. Wow. So it was beginning to, we were beginning to see an increase in black students at Ivy League schools.
Okay. And, and you didn't have any issues at Harvard at all with racism or segregation?
Of course you do. Of course you do. Harvard's no different than any place else.
Right.
It depends on who you deal with, It was not terribly overt, but you knew that there was that that group, that cadre of lawyers or lawyers-to-be who didn't appreciate the fact that they had been infiltrated by blacks.
Right.
But if that was reflected in the way they treated you in outside of class, you'd have black study groups as opposed to mixed study groups. Although you did have some mixed study groups, but for the most part, we stayed to ourselves.
Did you have a black student union there or anything like that?
Oh yeah, I was BALSA was started at NYU.
Okay.
And Harvard followed suit shortly thereafter, and so I was in one of the among the founders of BALSA at Harvard Law School.
Okay.
Yeah. So we had a group. It started. I guess it started. We went in 66. It started in 68, I think it was, right around the time of Martin Luther King's death, I think.
How did that affect you?
It was devastating, but it also gave us an opportunity to do something that we would not ordinarily have had an opportunity to do. There was writing in Cambridge,
right,
and in Boston, but we were able to monitor police conduct.
Okay,
as law students, we went down for the purpose of being on the scene to see how people were treated. But it was a very tense time, a very tense time.
You know, I often wondered, and I asked my dad this, you and my dad are around the same age, and I asked my dad, but it almost seemed like as a young black man at that time, you took sides, Malcolm X or Martin Luther King. Really? Where were you in that regard? Were you on the fence straddling it, or were you one more than the other?
Well, I think I was more in the King camp than the Malcolm X camp, because I'm not a pro-violence person, and in those days, we kind of looked at Malcolm X as being the more aggressive.
Okay.
And I wasn't that. I wasn't there.
Okay.
I had respect for him, although it was muted to some extent by the fact that I didn't have a whole lot of respect for Elijah Muhammad.
Understood.
See, that,
understood.
That there was a disconnect there. But I also thought that Malcolm X made a powerful case, no question about it. But then when you get right down to implementation, if you're talking about 100,000 to one, I'm going to go with something that's less aggressive.
Understood. I got you. Now, we go from Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. At this point, I'm going to speak about, you're already an attorney, and you hear about the Black Panther Party and that movement. What did you feel about them when you first heard or read about the Black Panther movement in Oakland? How did you feel about it?
I wasn't all that thrilled about it. I was concerned about their tendency to cause some issues, which could result in some violence that would not be beneficial to us.
Okay.
And then I started meeting them around here and learning more about them, and my attitude toward them changed a bit.
Okay.
There were people in, my brother married a young woman who had members of her family who were members of the Black Panther Party. And I saw what they were doing, and there were positive things that they were doing in the community. And that did change my attitude a bit.
Okay. Okay. So I just thought that a lot of the things that people heard weren't necessarily things that were true. You know what I mean?
Oh, no, I agree. Yeah. Well, you know, how it's reported is going to have some impact, no question about it.
Right.
And, of course, anything that is threatening, such as a party calling itself Black Panthers, maintaining its right to bear arms and to be aggressive in the defense of its people and its property, it definitely will not get good reviews from the mainstream press.
Okay.
So no, I understood that, but by the same token, I understood the ramifications if things got out of hand, and it was that which caused me some concern.
So tell me about some of these appointments of judgeship for you. You've been up the ladder to the top of the ladder here in the state of Maryland,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
as far as being a judge.
Well, I was appointed first by the best governor the state's ever had, Marvin Mandel.
Marvin Mandel, I remember.
Yeah, I was appointed to the district court by him, and then Harry Hughes appointed me two times. Once the first to the circuit court, which is the trial court of general jurisdiction, and to the court of special appeals, which is now called the Appellate Court of Maryland. They've changed the name.
Yeah, and I then, noticed that. I didn't know how you felt about that, because you were the first African American. Yeah, I was wondering how you felt about that. Yeah.
No. Well, two things. The Appellate Court of Maryland, I don't have a problem with.
Okay.
Because Court of Special Appeals is a misnomer.
Okay.
One needs to know that when the court was established, it was a court of special appeals. It only heard certain appeals. But as time passed and legislation was introduced, it became a court of general appeals, because every appeal went to the Court of Special Appeals, because the Supreme Court, the Court of Appeals at the time, was the was a court of limited jurisdiction, in the sense that it chose the cases that it wanted to hear. It was a certiorari court.
Got it.
Now, so I don't have a problem with the appellate court. I do have a problem with changing the name of the Court of Appeals to the Supreme Court. I don't think it changes anything at all. The Court of Appeals has always been the Supreme Court.
So why do you think it was changed?
Because a lot of people wanted to be called justice, and they were upset by the fact that other states had courts called the Supreme Court, and people automatically knew that was the Supreme Court. They didn't automatically know that it was the Court of Appeals was the Supreme Court of Maryland. It was an attitudinal thing and a perception thing. Not everybody was attuned to the fact that the Court of Appeals was the highest court of Maryland.
Okay.
And so they wanted to make sure that everybody knew that.
It
didn't make any difference to me. The Court of Appeals, by any other name, would act the same way.
Court of Appeals, yeah.
You know, it's the same thing.
Right.
So I was never in favor of the change in the name. Historically, the court goes back to the mid-17th century.
Oh wow!
It was called the Court of Appeals in the Constitution, the first Constitution of Maryland, 1776. It became the Court of Appeals. Now, why in the world isn't that good enough? You know, that's my attitude, and so and I told them so.
Well, a lot of people don't know that, you know, you've made history in that sense, where you became the first Chief Judge, the first Black Chief Judge
mm-hmm.
of the Maryland
mm-hmm.
Court of Appeals. What's it like to be in that position for the first time? There's always got to be a first. What's it like to be in that position as a Black man for the first time? Do you feel like you got the same respect, or you got the respect that you deserved?
Well, it starts out, it was different. I mean, over time, I think people got used to it, and a lot of people relished it and recognized that some of the things that I was doing needed to be done, and they were done well. But at the beginning, there were some disappointments because there was a thought that the chief judge of the Court of Special Appeals, who had been the judge who had been chief judge of the Court of Special Appeals, was also named to the Court of Appeals at the same time I was.
Okay.
And there was the thought that he ought to be named chief judge of the Court of Appeals because of his prior service as chief judge of the Court of Special Appeals.
Okay.
And so there were a lot of people who held that view and were not happy with the fact that I was named. But over time, I think things changed, and people were all right with it.
Well,
I think I got the respect that that should have been accorded to the office.
Okay.
Well, that's
good. That's good. That's progress.
Well, over time, yeah.
Over time.
Over time. It didn't happen overnight, but I served almost 17 years. So.
Right. I noticed that.
At the end of that time, I think, yeah, we had arrived.
They were used to you by that time.
Well, yeah, and a lot of them began to appreciate the fact that not only was I chief judge, but I was available and visible, not just in Baltimore City and Annapolis, where we sit, but I went around the state.
Okay.
And so they saw me. They heard me. They could reach out and touch me in a sense, you know.
Let me ask you something.
And they like that.
Well, let me ask you a question moving forward here a little bit. Seeing all the things that you've seen sitting on the bench for as long as you did, and reading all the things that you've read, in particular in the city, because this is where you've been all of your life pretty much, right? When you see crime at the rate that it is here in the city, you see the drug infestation, you see violent crime, especially with our young people, what do you think the reasons for that are? I mean, it's just really sad to me and confusing why the city, not the state, but so much the city budget hasn't done more to help young people find something to do. I just don't understand.
Well, leadership is part of it. And I mean leadership in terms of the schooling, the school leadership. I mean, I don't think we've done a good job in educating our young people. And I don't think that the police department has been handled in such a way as to prioritize in many ways many of the problems that cause crime. And until we start getting a handle on that, we're going to always have the problem. And I think when you get right down to it, it is drugs. And the fact that you don't have people doing the modeling in such a way as to discourage people moving into that direction. I used to live in the city, East Baltimore, and I lived there until I moved downtown 20 years ago. But I lived in the neighborhoods on purpose.
Okay.
Because I wanted the young people to see that it's possible to take a different path. I don't know how much good that does, but I mean, I think the more you
do it, the
better it's going to be.
Absolutely.
And the reason I did it was because when I grew up, we didn't have this extended black community.
Right.
We pretty much all were in the same neighborhood.
Right.
And you had your lawyers, you had your preachers, you had your ministers, your teachers. In fact, my teacher lived up the street from us. And if you did something in school, then they'd drop by and tell your parents and you got what for. And so you saw all of the possibilities right there around you all the time.
Right.
And as we moved out into the suburbs and we got, started doing better, we started to abandon that community relationship.
Right.
And then we started talking about them and they and us and I and, distinguishing between those who've done well and those who haven't.
Right.
And I think that has something to do with it, too. You don't have the same role model there. You don't have the same opportunity to see success and reach out and touch it. I mean, you can see it, but that's different from knowing it. You know what I mean?
Right. Which asks the question: Did integration really help, or did it hurt black people?
Well, I've changed my mind on that one. I used to be a big proponent of the integration thing. I'm not so sure anymore, because as I think back to Dunbar, back in those days, we had PhDs at Dunbar, you know.
Right.
And we had teachers who were just committed to making sure that we did all right. I'm not sure that we have the same commitment that we had in those days.
Right.
Or the same burning desire to succeed as a teacher in terms of inspiring the young people. I don't think we've got that. And so I think I'm better off for having gone through that system as it was.
Okay.
Than I would have been had I been alive today and in school today.
So then let me ask you this question.
Mm-hmm.
If you had to do it all over again, would you still have had your sit-in? If you knew that your sit-in would lead to integration and everything else.
That doesn't change. You know, in fact, I'd be even more committed if I had to do over again and knew what I know now. Because, quite frankly, we're refighting those same battles right now.
Right.
The more things change, the more they remain the same, I'm afraid.
Correct.
Because, you know, I gave a speech to a church that was 170, 180 some years old, just before the Civil War. And do you know, the issues before that before that church back then are exactly the same issues before us today.
Wow.
No matter what progress we've made, we always manage to come back to a place where we're still fighting about voting rights.
Right.
We're still fighting about citizenship, basically. Because, I mean, even though the Constitution says we're citizens, you can find so many instances where there is a disparity in treatment based on skin color and ethnicity and whatnot. And so you're still fighting those same battles all over again. And the criminal thing is the same. I mean, you have a disparity in sentencing and whatnot. So, I mean, we're still fighting those fights. And so, yeah, I would have been even more committed if I knew what I know now and I had to do it all over again. I might have been even more aggressive about it.
Do you think that, and time's running away from us, but I do want to ask you a couple more questions, if you don't mind.
Sure.
As a kid, I grew up under the governorship of Marvin Mandel and the mayorship of Mayor Schaefer. And I don't ever remember city officials being arrested and indicted and prosecuted at the rate of city officials are now.
No.
You know, mayors and state's attorneys and, like, what's going on? Like, what is that all about?
Well, it could be as simple as what we saw at the national level. There could have been an unwritten rule that you don't do that to public officials.
Okay.
Remember now, there was a rule that you didn't charge presidents, right?
Correct.
Well,
correct.
That's not what the Constitution says. The Constitution says nobody's above the law.
Correct.
And so they should have been charging presidents and everybody else. And I suspect, because you've also heard of the fact that newspapers used to avoid disclosing information that would paint a particular politician in a bad light.
Right.
Because, you just didn't do it. It might be just as simple as that. They just didn't enforce it. They didn't go after the public officials to the same extent that they do now.
Do you think it's a race issue? Because most of our public officials in the city are black?
Oh, well, I'm sure that's part of it. But it also, in those days, I think it had to do with just didn't make any difference who they were. They just weren't going to do it because they were, they treated them with a certain degree of respect that nobody else was. And so they were treated as being above the law.
Okay.
As that bar was lowered, then yes, they started getting public officials, politicians, but also they're more willing to go after the blacks because it's, you know, it's
easier
to be more accepted to the acceptable by the public, I guess.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned earlier that Marvin Mandel was the best governor that Maryland has ever had, in your opinion. How do you think Wes Moore is going to do?
Well, he's got the potential to do well if he follows through on what he's saying. If the approach he's taking, if he can make it work, he could very well supplant Marvin Mandel.
Okay.
Okay. I mean, the potential is there. I mean, there's no question about that.
Right.
What he has to worry about is making sure that when Mandel was a master politician, he got the legislature to do some things that people wouldn't have thought he could get them to do.
Okay.
He'd been the Speaker of the House and that sort of thing, so he knew the legislature. He knew it cold. He knew all of the maneuvers that you could make to get things done. Wes does not have that background.
Okay.
So he's going to have to rely on the folk around him to mold the legislature to his will to get things done that he wants, that he believes are necessary to be done in order to accomplish the goals he set for himself. But the potential is certainly there, because he's got a Democratic legislature.
Yes.
It's a question of being able to lead them and collaborate with them in such a way as to get all of his priorities done.
Wow. Well, look, this this time has literally, I mean, it's flown by. I can't believe we're already 40 minutes into this conversation. It's crazy.
Oh, okay.
Crazy.
I haven't even looked at it.
No, I don't care. I'm not going to edit anything.
Okay.
But I appreciate you so much. What are you doing these days? You're retired, obviously, from the bench. But what else are you doing?
Occasionally I will give a speech or two. Generally, I don't do a whole lot of anything. I read the paper every day.
Come on, Joe. You don't just seem like that guy.
Somebody asked Thurgood Marshall when he said he was going to retire, Thurgood, what are you going to do when you retire? You know what he told him?
What's that?
I'm going to sit on my butt.
Okay.
That's what he said. I have always tried to emulate Thurgood Marshall.
Okay.
And I'm emulating him in that respect as well.
Not a bad man to emulate, you know?
No, but I mean, I do things from time to time, but I do it only when I want to do it. And, I don't know. Since I've retired, it's almost 10 years now, you know, I don't have the same facility as I used to have in terms of speaking and whatnot. So I just pick and choose.
Well, you still sound really great, and you're still rapid fire, so you got a long time before you have to give up giving speeches, I can promise you that.
No, it's not a question. I don't want to give it up. I just want to do it when I want to.
I understand.
In the old days, you know, I used to give speeches all the time. I had to.
Right.
And that was part of your job. It's not part of my job anymore. I can pick and choose, and that's what I'm going to do.
I understand.
If I think it's going to make a difference or it's going to have an impact, I'll do it.
What?
Otherwise, I'd just as soon stay home, particularly given the pandemic, you know,
right.
COVID, that sort of stuff. And I've got asthma, so, you know, I've got to be somewhat careful.
Well, I am so glad that you chose to speak with me today, because it does make a difference. I mean,
Let me just say this to you. If Laura says do it, guess what?
You do it.
I do it.
She got that kind of juice.
Like she used to tell her father, you know. And get him to do anything.
Well,
no, I've known Laura forever, you know. So.
Well, I appreciate you, Judge. I really, really do, Judge Bell. And you are now an official member of On the Weekend Edition and 1500 Radio, and we will definitely, me particularly, be in touch.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you, sir. Bye-bye.
Righto. Bye-bye.
Well, that was fun. I mean, I'm a little geeked out right now. I'm going to be honest with you. I mean, that was Chief Judge Robert M. Bell. And I don't know that I could adequately express the significance of this man's career and what it meant to black lawyers and judges in this state and around the country. He was a pioneer, and he was on my show. So yeah, I'm a little geeked out right now, but it'll be okay. I'll be all right. I know you hear the music, and that really means that it is time for the Petty. He's going to dial up some picks for us for next week's Super Bowl, because there are no games this week, but we still have a lot to talk about. So let's give the Petty a call.
Brother B, happy Sunday to you.
Thank you, sir. It is the Petty here today. Now listen, I know I'm disturbing you, because I know you got all kinds of plans and theories going on for the upcoming Super Bowl next week, but I wanted you to talk to me about some of the things that are going on in the NFL in reference to the Black history we're about to experience.
Well, first of all, you must congratulate me, because I told everyone, Eagles, Chiefs, the guys from the Midwest meet the guys from the East in the desert. We might as well call this the Andy Reid Bowl, because as you know, he was the head coach of the Philadelphia Eagles for 14 years, and he's been Kansas City Chiefs for 10 years, taking both teams to Super Bowls.
Is he the first person to do this? Like, is he the first coach to do this?
To the best of my knowledge, well, no, because he's not the only coach to take teams to Super Bowls before with two different organizations. Dick Vermeil's done it. He did it with the Eagles, and he did it with the Rams.
Right, but so, I mean, is he the first coach to actually play against a team that he has taken to the Super Bowl in the Super Bowl?
To the best of my knowledge, I would have to say yes.
Okay.
And that's a little bit of history there. But the biggest part of history, and as we mentioned, Black History Month, that you have two Black starting quarterbacks, and that's a first.
Yeah, it is. It is.
And that's huge.
Getting back to what you said, I will congratulate you. I'll give you your props, because I certainly had the Bengals and the 49ers in the Super Bowl. I mean, I really, really did. But
As much as it hurt me to go against my Niners, I just thought the Eagles were a better team for obvious reasons.
Right. Well, but I got to tell you, I got to say, to my credit, I did say last week that people should listen to you, because what you do is based on your fact and your knowledge. And what I do is based on just, you know, my feeling. So,
well, sometimes you got to go with your head and not with your heart. And last week, as much as I wanted to go with my heart, I had to go with my head.
Yeah, well, it won out. It won out. I did listen to you, though, for sure. So, listen, in reference to this whole thing with two Black quarterbacks in the Super Bowl, now, we've only had one instance where we had two Black head coaches, and that was Dungy and Lovie Smith, right?
That's correct.
And so this is the first time that we're having two Black quarterbacks. I've heard a lot of stuff going on. I know Doug Williams made a comment about how he feels about it, and he says it's been too long in coming. Do you think it's been intentional, or do you think it's just, I don't know, Black quarterbacks have not been good enough to this point where two are playing in the Super Bowl at the same time?
Well, I don't think it's been intentional. As you know, Russell Wilson has been there before, and he's won the Super Bowl with Seattle. And Colin Kaepernick has been there where he almost won with the 49ers. So it's not been intentional. It's just a matter of the organizations picking the right guy to fit that organization for them to put them in the best position to get into the Super Bowl. And, you know, this is something rare where you have two coaches that looked at the talent that they had, Andy Reid with Mahomes and Nick Sirianni with Jalen Hurts, and saying, you know what? I can build around these two guys, and I can build a team that can get us to the Super Bowl. And sure enough, it's happened. You know, I think that might be a thing in the future where coaches look at the Black quarterback and say, hey, this is what we kind of need. This is what's you know, moving forward for us.
Yeah, because for the longest time, they were saying that the only quarterbacks that will ever make it into the Super Bowl were pocket passers, or people who sat back and threw the ball. That the athletic quarterback, though flashy and gimmicky, was not good enough to make it to a Super Bowl. So now we've got two of them.
Well, see, here's the thing with the difference of the quarterbacks. With a pocket passer, the defense has the advantage because you're basically kind of playing 10 against 11. Whereas with a mobile quarterback, say like your Pat Mahomes or Jalen Hurts, you have to account for him as that man too. So you're definitely now playing 11 against 11.
Good point.
And that makes a big difference on how you scheme your defense, how you can design plays, and to me, it makes it a much more exciting game.
So then why do you think coaches have been so reluctant to go to that that offensive scheming.
Well, now that you're seeing some of the quarterbacks, and I mean, Andy Reid is no spring chicken, but some of the younger the head coaches are starting to say that, you know what, this is what we need to get us over the top. You know, Baltimore for the longest time had pocket passers, and then they went with Lamar Jackson because they saw what Lamar Jackson could do as far as elevating the Ravens to a higher level.
Yeah, but it was two pocket passers that took him to a Super Bowl.
But you also have to remember that the Ravens defense, they had a very excellent defense at that time.
Very true.
And their defense was kind of shaky because Lamar's not out there playing defense. He's putting him in a good position to win.
Right.
The defense isn't holding up. They're not doing their part.
No, good point. Good point. So have you heard anything more about Lamar?
I haven't heard anything. Well, the word is he's not going anywhere. If they can't get a deal done, he'll be franchised. Bottom line. There have been some rumors out there that he may go to another team, and it's like, it's not happening. He's not going anywhere. He will be a Raven next year.
Right.
And whether or not he plays, that remains to be seen, but he will be a Raven. They will franchise him.
All right, well, that's good news. Who do you have, and this is, who do you have, and I know I'm going to come back to you next week and ask you the same thing, but right now, who do you have winning the Super Bowl?
Right now, as we speak today, and we're 7 days away, and my mind may change within that 7 days, but right now, I'm leaning more towards Kansas City than Philadelphia.
Really?
Now, that's subject to change. At first, I was leaning a lot towards Philly because of what I've seen. I've seen a lot of Philadelphia games. Well, I've seen everybody play, but I've seen more Philadelphia, and because I live in the area, I've heard more things about that team than I have with Kansas City. See, the Patrick Mahomes thing is the problem. You know, he's very mobile. When he's mobile, he's good. His mobility is kind of limited right now. But as things progress over these next couple of weeks, if he gets even better, Philly's going to have a problem because have they really seen a quarterback of his status the whole season? If you look at Philadelphia's schedule, if you look at who they played in the playoffs, Daniel Jones, Danny Dimes, he's up and coming. But he's not there. They basically played no quarterback when they played the 49ers. So who have they really played? Have they played anyone of Patrick Mahomes' caliber? Slow that defense down? I mean, that offense down. Can Philadelphia's offense slow down Kansas City's defense?
Well, you know, the first loss that they took was to Taylor Heinicke. And Heinicke is very creative. He runs when he needs to run, and he throws from all angles. So You're right. I mean, that might be Philly's Achilles heel.
And we really don't know what would have happened in that 49er Philly game if Brock Purdy doesn't get hurt.
You're right. You're absolutely right.
You know, because they threw that washed-up bum Josh Johnson in there. And frankly, you could just turn your TVs off because you knew the game was going to be over. But, you know, you have to think that can that defense contain Patrick Mahomes? And right now, maybe they can, because his mobility is limited. But as I said, have they really seen anyone of that type of caliber? Really, their whole season. You have to look at every game Philly played this year. And the only quarterback they played that was close to maybe Patrick Mahomes was Justin Fields, because he's very mobile.
Right.
And he's not that experienced. And Chicago gave Philly a hard time. If you recall, that's the game when Jalen Hurts got injured.
Right.
So that's something to think about.
Well, I'm going to ask you one more question, and then I'm going to let you roll. Why do you think, because now Jalen Hurts is in the Super Bowl, right? Trevor Lawrence, Joe Burrows, Danny Dimes, even Brock Purdy. Like, they give all of these quarterbacks their just due, like right out the gate, before they even throw their first pass. Jalen Hurts has been in the league, what, 3 years now starting?
Yes. He's been a starter twice. He's been in the league for 3 years. It's his second year as a starter.
Why are they just now giving this young man his respect? Because he's been playing hard and at a high level since he took over as a starter.
Well, Brother B, you know what? You really don't have to answer that question because we all know what it is. And I don't want to pull that card, but it is what it is. And let me tell you a little something, because I live up in the Philadelphia area, and before the season started, they really did not want him to be the starter.
Right.
They were looking at Russell Wilson, and see what Russell Wilson did out in Denver.
Right.
They was talking about getting somebody else. Let's trade for this guy. Let's try to do this. They had no faith in him. And I was thinking to myself, you know what? This young man, he struggled his first year as a starter with a new head coach and a new offensive coordinator, and they still made it to the playoffs. And I was saying to myself and anyone else that will listen, give this man a chance. Second year coach. Now they have the chance to look at all the film from the first year of them being together and saying, you know what? This is how we're going to plan our offense. This is how we're going to attack other teams. And that's what they've done. I honestly believe that Nick Sirianni should receive Coach of the Year. I believe Jalen Hurts should be the MVP. Now, that's just my opinion. But you can see that once they had time to figure out this is what we have with each other as a coach and as a player, let's build that team around him. And not to mention, let's get him the talent that he needs to be successful, a la going out and getting A.J. Brown.
Right, right.
A la beefing up the defense to put them in a better field position when they receive the ball. So when you take all those things into consideration, sometimes you have to look, sit back and just look and say, let's give this brother a chance to see what he can do.
Well,
he was not a bad college player because you saw that.
No, he was an excellent college player. And he got shafted in college.
Exactly. And he's playing on a high level because you're not going to tell me that young man doesn't have a chip on his shoulder. I don't care what anyone says. I know he's heard some of the things that were said about him.
Right.
And he's going out to say that, you know what? You guys don't know what you're talking about. I'm going to prove everyone wrong. And he's done it 15-1 as a starter. That speaks
volumes. That's strong.
You know, they say they didn't have a strong arm. He's whipping the ball down the field, 40, 50 yards down the field to Devontae Smith and A.J. Brown.
Right.
They say he runs too much. He makes very good decisions. He doesn't turn the ball over a lot. He has a very good offensive coordinator. He's a very good coach. And they believe in him. And now the people of Philadelphia are believing in him. And they're such a bunch of hypocrites because I can recall everything that was said last year, back in August, back in July, back in April, in May, when the season was really, this football season was really beginning to start. And if you realize that the NFL doesn't end with the Super Bowl, that's a 24-hour, 7-day a week, 365-day year business. So
right.
I've heard a lot of things about Jalen Hurts being a quarterback this past season. And I'm happy for that young man. I'm happy to see what the Philadelphia Eagles are doing. I'm glad they're in the Super Bowl. And to be honest with you, I really hope they win the Super Bowl.
Yeah, so do I. So do I. I mean, I really, really do. I really do. All right, man. Well, listen, I know you're all you're on your grind like always, and I appreciate the time today, even though there are no games. But I'm going to come back to you next week, and we're going to ask you if you've changed your mind. We'll see.
Well, come back next week, and I might even give you the score of who may win next week.
Okay. All right, man. You have yourself a great Sunday, brother. Have a great week.
You have a great Sunday. Have a great week. Always a pleasure speaking to you. I got to go. Peace.
Peace, brother. Well, there you heard it from the Petty. We've come to the end of a very fast hour this Sunday morning. Please, please join me next week. We have another great guest. And enjoy this week. Enjoy this Sunday. Relax, clean up the house, or just sleep, whatever you want to do. But tomorrow, wake up, conquer the world, and stop doing nothing, because the best thing about doing nothing, like I always say, is you can quit whenever you want. Please make sure you get at me on IG, at On with Brian Pettaway. Let me know how you feel about today's show. But most of all, just enjoy life, people. It is very, very short, and you never know when it's your time. Rest in peace, Uncle Mickey. I love you. I gotta go, people. Happy Sunday. Peace.